Hello and welcome to a world where designers take up residencies at the London Zoo and where ants are performing ballets. My name is Régine de Batty and you are listening to Artists in Laboratories on Resonance FM. Every week I'm inviting an artist, a designer, a hacker or a scientist to join me in the studio and talk about creative ways to engage with science and technology. And my guest at Resonance today is Holly Palmer. Hello, Holly.
Hi, Regine.
Holly Palmer is a designer, he's an artist, he's also a tutor in the Interactive Architecture Workshop at the Bartlett School of Architecture. He's also a Getty Images contributing photographer, which impressed me a lot. I think we've had our fair share of artists and designers developing highly surprising projects in this show, but Holly's ideas are particularly unusual. He's interested in dancing insects and in intercontinental ant communication. Working with scientists from University College London and with the Institute of Zoology, Holly has been working on a six-year research project to stage an ant ballet. The work uses a robotic arm that sprays synthesized pheromone that causes a colony of ants to follow artificial trails in preference to their own natural foraging behavior. So, Holly, one of the things I really like about your project is that it gets people's attention right from the title. It's called The Ant Ballet. It's quite seducing and it's also, I think, an absurd idea. And I'm really sorry for starting with the most obvious question in the world, but where did you get this idea to choreograph ants?
Well, I'm really glad you used the word absurd there, because one of the main kind of influences for the project was the Theatre of the Absurd. So kind of the plays of Beckett and Pinter and Ionesco and that kind of thing, where there's always this kind of sense that something else is in control of your life. I mean, all of that kind of school of literature came out of this kind of post-Second World War period, and there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of kind of godless feeling in the world. But there was this kind of, there's an underlying feeling with all of those plays that there's something else in control of what you're doing. And I was reading a lot of this stuff and I'm watching lots of kind of Kubrick films where, again, in, for example, Space Odyssey, you have HAL, who's this kind of control system controlling a computer that controls the kind of people on board a ship, and nobody quite knows. It's almost, with both of those things, you get the feeling that there's almost a puppeteer behind the scenes kind of controlling what people are doing. And so I was immersing myself a lot in that kind of literature and those kind of references and things, whilst reading a lot about ants. And I've had a kind of long fascination with ants. I just find them really interesting as insects, and as kind of, I just like ants. but one of the things that I got thinking about with them is the way they communicate differently to us. And so where we use kind of speech and kind of the built environment and all sorts of other ways to communicate, they largely communicate via the environment and via pheromone signals. Mm-hmm. And it's, if you read really old literature about ants, they'll always talk about kind of the queen underground pulsing out signals and kind of telling the ants exactly what to do. And you watch sort of a Tom and Jerry cartoon and there's one ant in the front who kind of has a bugle and tells them exactly what to do. But they really use, I mean, on the whole, they use pheromones to communicate. And it just struck me that the way that they operate, and once I got a few kind of ants in the studio and started to kind of watch them, they seem to feel around for the environment and take so much of their cue from that that it's almost like they're being controlled by something else, very much like the kind of the stuff that you get in all the kind of Beckett plays, where you're not quite sure what's going on, but you're just going to go with it because that's all you can really do. So I started thinking about that kind of stuff and how you would take advantage and kind of hack into their system. And the idea of kind of synthesizing pheromones came up. And I went to, I knew I wanted to do something with ants, so I went to London Zoo and I spoke to a scientist who was there called Dr. Sirian Sumner. And we had this long conversation about a million different things. But the idea of synthesizing pheromones came up and potentially using that as a way to kind of cause ants to move in different ways with their natural behavior. And that was really the seed of the idea. That's where it all came from.
But did you yourself, or did you get some help to synthesize Fernand?
So
it must be quite complex.
Yeah, for the synthesis itself, I'm by no means a scientist. Uh-huh. I'm a kind of designer and artist, and I went to speak to a guy called Professor Jim Anderson from UCL Organic Chemistry, mm-hmm. and it's really good when you start kind of speaking to scientists about doing a ridiculous project like this. You either get the reaction that they just close the door on you completely, and you'll speak to somebody at a conference and they'll just go, don't do that. That's really silly. You're not a real scientist. Or you get people like Jim and Sirian who are just really open-minded and want to do kind of projects like this. So we made a matrix of the 184 ants that at the time they knew what the pheromone compounds were. And then we worked out the complexity of those pheromones and how likely they would be to make ants move and how well documented that process is.
Okay.
And we got it down to kind of, we kind of worked backwards with it. So we took the 184 ants that we knew what pheromones there were, and then we worked out what the easiest pheromone compound would be to synthesize that was a direct trail compound. And that got us down to a short list of about six ants. And then we took the one that we kind of liked the look of the most in terms of what the effect of the pheromone was, mm-hmm. which turned out was the Argentine ant, Linopthenema humal. And the pheromone compound was called Z9 hexadecinol. And
did it exist, this pheromone, or did they have to create it for you?
They had to build it specially.
Okay.
And it's quite a complex procedure. It had something like 24 stages to actually build the pheromone. And what's funny about the pheromones is they use really simple building blocks. So they're pretty much just hydrogen and carbon. And some have a couple of extra bits, but yeah, pretty much just hydrogen and carbon, but put together in really clever ways. And you get all sorts of funny things going on with the pheromones, where some of them, if you put the compounds in water, they'll spin a certain direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called chirality. And you can have kind of the same pheromone produced in two different ways. Almost like when you have a hand, you can have a right hand or a left hand. And if someone reaches out to mm-hmm. shake your hand with their right hand, you automatically pull out your left, you know, your right yeah. hand. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. And that's how the receptors within the ants work as well. So if at one stage in the process you mess up the chirality of your pheromone, you have to destroy the whole batch. And so it's a really expensive and really quite complex procedure to make ant pheromones. And for that reason, I mean, you can buy them commercially, but they cost a fortune. It's $3,700 per gram.
Yeah.
It's more expensive than gold. I mean, more expensive than most compounds in the world.
So, you know, you were mentioning that when you go to a scientist with an unusual idea, sometimes they would just slam the door at your face and say you're crazy and other go along with the idea. So they went along with the idea, the scientists you contact. You know why? What did, because, as you say, it's a complex procedure to synthesize this pheromone. It's also expensive. So why do you think they did that for you? Did it bring something to their research? Or?
With Sirian, we're doing a kind of joint research project at the moment, which we've been meaning to do for a couple of years. And we finally kind of found the resources and the means to do it at London Zoo. And yeah, we're just personally really interested in this stuff. To be able to kind of mix it up with research that she wants to do anyway is really convenient.
Mm-hmm.
But with the pheromone synthesis, I think it just kind of ticks that wacky box where somebody's generally interested in it. There's a lot of... I think you get quite a lot of really dry research proposals as mm-hmm. a scientist, and you get lots of kind of people asking you to do stuff that's either been done before or that's based on your previous research and something like that. And I hope, I don't know what it is particularly about this one that leapt out to everyone who's been involved, but it's just been really fun to work on. And I really enjoyed the conversation as well, where kind of two people from completely different backgrounds will be talking about things and trying to hash out an idea and to make something really work. Because, I mean, you're talking about some fairly complex science involved in kind of, you know, the synthesis of pheromones or investigating communication patterns and things like that. But it's really nice to be able to have that conversation and reach a kind of mutual conclusion at the end and produce something together.
Did you realize it would be so complex?
I didn't. When I first when I first thought about doing this project, I thought it would be maybe a month's worth of stuff.
Oh, God. And now it's a 6 year.
And now it's 6 years of my life.
Yeah. So now you got the ants and you have the pheromone. What else? How does it work, this ant ballet? Once you have these two ingredients, what else do you need, and how do you make them? How do you choreograph them, and how do you make them want to do?
Essentially, the project has four phases, kind of like the film Phase 4, which is about ants taking over the world in four phases. My ants probably won't take over the world, but...
Please.
But in their four phases, they'll do kind of various different things. So the first stage, which is Phase 1, which is the one that you came to see in Future Everything in Manchester last year, we've proven that you can make ants move using synthesized pheromones. So we took the powdered pheromone compound and a giant robotic arm and drew, essentially the patterns were really simple and arbitrary mm-hmm. on the ground. And then when the ants woke up in the morning, kind of after this machine spraying pheromones all night, a few of them followed the patterns. And so that's kind of the first stage, is kind of this large robotic arm in the middle of a giant kind of test bed that sprays pheromones out for ants to follow. The next stage is going to be to properly choreograph that. So I'm going to be working with a team of choreographers just interesting people to work out how to create a kind of beautiful and poetic
ant ballet. Like real choreographer who usually work with humans.
Yeah. To see, because I think, again, it's taking something that you would do quite naturally. It takes you out of your comfort zone and will be quite interesting.
How many ants are going to perform?
We had the first, the video that's on my website at the moment, we used 14,000 ants, and all of them were manually sucked up as well. So you get this funny little kind of plastic tube with a kind of a tube at each end and a bit of woman's tights stuck at one end to stop them going into your mouth, and then you suck them up. And we sucked up about 14,000 for that. But then this one I could see using a lot more than that. Because I have a new arena which could take thousands. So
So the system works a bit like, what was the name of that animal who has a very long nose?
Anteater.
Yeah, that's the same system?
Similar thing, but we don't eat them.
You don't eat them, that's good. Should we have a pause and listen to the music you brought? What was it again?
It's a song by Lucky Dragons called Helicopter de Cristal, and I really like this band.
Okay, thank you.
Cuando de ti me enamoré, aquella noche junto al mar que entre la risa y el cantar yo te besé, hermosa y triste vocación que vivirás eternamente en mi We'll be right back.
And if I understand correctly, you are not working with any kind of ant. You're working with Argentinian ants in particular. So can you bring them, import them easily in the UK, or do they have to go through quarantine, or do you need some special permissions to get them in England?
This is a big issue with Argentine ants in the UK. Argentine ants are really crazily invasive. They're a species that has kind of natively from Argentina, and they've kind of colonized a lot of the world, and they do that through a process called unicolonization, which essentially means that they can. Most ants of any species, so the kind of ants that you have in your garden will be probably Lasius niger or Lasius flavius or something like that. If you have two colonies, one in your garden and one in your neighbor's garden, when they come and meet each other, they'll fight.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll fight to the death, and that's how they kind of draw their boundaries between where the territories lie. So if one ant strays into the other one's nest, then it's going to be kind of, they'll recognize the hydrocarbons on its skin and they'll kill it. These ants don't do that. These ants are really like super friendly to each other, to the extent that they kind of have a natural advantage over all the other ants. So they don't bother fighting with their neighbors of the same species. And that enables them to kind of form these huge colonies where you can take ants from anywhere and just kind of mix them up, and they'll go, hey, great, where do I work? Where do I sleep? That kind of thing. And so they formed the biggest super colony we know of is it stretches from the northwest tip of Spain right the way through the Portuguese coast, through the southern, the whole way around the south of Spain, right the way through kind of the south of France, and then halfway down through Italy. So it's kind of 6,000 kilometers long. And it's one giant colony, or classed as one kind of giant colony. So you can imagine that the UK ecologists who kind of work with ants and who know about this kind of stuff are really keen that we don't get them into the UK.
But do they damage the environment, or are they just nasty to other species of ants?
They're really nasty to other species of ants. They're really nasty to other species of ants. So they could potentially kind of cause huge damage to our native species of ants. Oh. But of course, that has kind of high-level ecological damages because the ants form a significant part of the food chain. So if they did get into the UK, they could kind of wipe out a lot of our species, which is really bad.
Is it what happened in Spain and France?
And a lot of biodiversity has been lost. And most giant kind of ant colonies who've moved around the world, so you get kind of the red fire ant in the US, they originally come from Brazil. And it's not that I have anything against South American ants, but they have kind of an evolutionary advantage a lot of the time. So... And they'll fly around the world on planes, not like they book the tickets, but they'll end up kind of inadvertently climbing onto a plane and then flying to, you know, like Texas or something, and then setting up colonies there, and then they spread. And this is exactly how the Argentine ants have spread. So one of the things I'm looking at with Syrian in the long term is how to come up with a couple of things that would stop ants like that invading. So that's potentially one of the kind of biological things that we're looking at with the project. The Argentine ants pose a huge threat to the UK ecosystem. And I've spoken to people like DEFRA, who are the Department for the Environment, Farming and Agriculture and things like that. And they've told me in strict terms not to bring these ants to the UK. There's no chance you could do it because just the risk is too great. So all the experiments I do with the Argentine ants mm-hmm. have to be done in places where they're kind of native already. So I go down to Barcelona and do tests there.
Okay, that's a nice place to go.
Which, yeah. And conveniently, they only live in really nice places. So.
Yeah. But also, I was wondering, once you have your little dancers for your ballet, how is the ballet going to look like? And because these ants are really tiny, so how does the public going to enjoy the ballet? Is it through a video documentation or through big lenses?
There's probably going to be a lot of cameras embedded in whatever structure it ends up kind of with the second phase of the ant ballet being. And I have a load of prototype webcams in my studio at the moment. I'm playing around with it for kind of showing different ways of sensing or, you know, perceiving the ants.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like exhibitions where people can come and engage with the exhibition. and see something physical. I think that's a really important part of this kind of thing, and particularly where the art itself is kind of, it has a real scientific imperative behind it. I think that actually engaging the public with something is really important. So there will be video aspects to it and kind of time-lapse videos that kind of get shown online and that kind of thing. But a lot of it's going to be kind of almost participatory stuff that the audience can come in some way be a part of it and influence what the ants are doing. But there'll be lots of kind of, embedded webcams and viewing panes. The new ant enclosure that I have... that was built by a company called Corian, has a fantastic little kind of viewing platform underneath, so you can kind of get under it and see how the ants are nesting in the kind of, I guess it's like the green room for the ants.
Where are you going to do that? Because you cannot do it in the UK, so in Spain?
The next one that I know about is going to be probably in Brazil.
Okay.
But we're just waiting on a timescale for that one.
Okay.
And that will be part of Festival.
Festival. It's what kind of... Festival is Festival?
So Festival is a fantastic festival. It's run by Bridget Nichols, and it's all about the art, insects in art, and the art of being an insect. And they take people who do really interesting stuff, like Chris Watkins, who does all of the recording for David Attenborough programs, and all the sound stuff. And they do kind of live performances with crickets. And they do a load of really, really interesting projects with Festival. Building giant termite nests kind of on a human scale and stuff like that. So yeah, it's this kind of circus of insect related artists.
And another question I was wondering is, does using pheromone to manipulate the path of the ants come with ethical dilemmas? Did you get PETA or any similar organization knocking at your door and threatening you and saying you have to leave these ants in peace, otherwise we will bring you to court?
We don't directly. All of these stuff that we're doing, so the experiment we're doing in London Zoo at the moment, we had to fill out a number of ethics forms to get kind of permission to do stuff like that. I haven't had any animal rights kind of campaigners knocking on my door or setting fire to effigies of me or anything like that yet. But essentially, we're not doing anything mean to the ants. We're doing, they still get fed. You know, all of my ants are really well fed. They get honey water, which is probably better than what they get in the wild. And they get, you know, plenty of rest time. And, you know, there are ways of making sure that the ants are well kept and nicely kind of looked after and that kind of thing. But no, I personally don't have any ethical problems with causing the ants to do different things with communication pheromones, because essentially it's the same as sort of misdirecting people in the public. And I think that the place that I draw the line is if I started killing hundreds of ants, which is really bad. But one of the things that really surprised me when I first started working with ants is that a lot of the scientists who you work with I've always thought that scientists who get into kind of insect research would be doing it from a point of view where they really care about the individual insect. And in the same way that when you when you think about somebody who works for the conservation of rhinos, they're going to care about every last rhino. But of course, there are way fewer rhinos, and rhinos are a lot bigger, so you have to really protect them. But one of the ways that you identify Argentine ants is by squashing a load of them and then seeing what they smell like. And so in order to do this work that is in some way conserving some aspect of nature, you have to kill like a certain amount of them. And a lot of insect identification, you have to kill the ants before, or you have to kill the insects before you can identify them, because otherwise they just don't stand still long enough. So it's a really funny thing where you're looking at the conservation of a system as a whole as opposed to the individual.
You have to sacrifice. And I read also on your website that you're also interested in intercontinental ant communication and in setting up a way for the ants to communicate with each other around the world. So that's why, and how would you do that?
So the way that you do that... this is phase three of the ant ballet. So phase one was kind of just proving that the ants will follow pheromone trails. Phase two is going to be choreographing the ants. Phase three is this intercontinental ant communication. And phase four is this kind of undetermined phase where a lot of destruction is going to happen. But phase three, the intercontinental ant communication, essentially when the ants are talking to each other, they're doing it via pheromones. Mm-hmm. So as an ant walks along, it will lay a trail if it's found food, and the other ants will find that trail and follow it to get the food. So if you have kind of one ant that's done that, the other ants are like a bit likely to walk down that path and get food. And if you have 100 ants that have walked down that path and reinforced it, the ants are really likely to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, by doing a load of experiments with quantities of pheromones, we can see the likelihood of ants following a trail. So we're not entirely sure yet what sort of 0.5 milligrams of pheromones spread across 100 meters actually means to the ants. We know that it has an effect on them, but we're not entirely sure how much effect that has. Mm-hmm. But once we've worked this out, you can do an approximation through kind of having a load of computer vision systems set up above ants to work out what one colony is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And to work out what the likelihood of their trail is being sort of with a 100 ant density or a 200 ant density and that kind of thing. And then print that information using the synthesized pheromones to ants on the other side of the world.
Okay.
So essentially you're hacking into the ant communication protocol.
Okay.
And you're tapping into the kind of higher level communication that operates within the ant colonies so that we can see exactly what one colony is doing and print it to another colony. And together they can either kind of collectively find food resources or kind of almost have like a mini Cold War going on where they're kind of fighting against an enemy that doesn't really exist and that kind of thing.
Okay. Last question. Do you have any upcoming projects, exhibition ideas that we should be looking forward to?
The next thing I have coming up is I'm making a film this year about the Godot machine, which is a device that holds an ant in place for as long as possible. So it's looking at the psychology behind individual ants, and it's essentially a big ball that you put an ant on top of, and it's robotically controlled. And as the ant walks forwards, the ball moves backwards, and as the ant walks right, the ball moves left. So the ant is always kind of on top of its world.
How long does an ant live?
It depends on the species. The Argentine ants can live, I think it's between sort of 3 months to a year or so.
Okay.
But it depends how hard they work, how much sleep they have, a lot of factors. But yeah, it really depends. You get some big ants who live a long time. You get ants who live for a couple of years. And queens can live. So the queens of standard UK garden ants live for a sort of 10, 15 years or so.
Okay, that's a long time. Thank you so much for coming to the studio, Oli, and thank you to everybody who's been listening. If you want to know more about Oli's work and his ants, do check out his website. The address is olipalmer.com. And there goes the last episode of Artists in Laboratories of the year 2012, and I hope to talk to you in 2013.
Thanks so much for having me, Regine.
Thank you, Oli.